All right, I'll go ahead and call the meeting to order. So welcome everybody to the March 26th meeting of the Ad Hoc Nevada State College Presidential Search Committee. The first item is roll call. Winter, would you please take roll?
Chair Carvalho?
Here.
Regent Carter? Regent Del Carlo?
I'm here.
Regent McMichael?
Here.
Regent Perkins? You have a quorum present. Advisory members, Dr. Barton? Ms. Brown?
Present.
Thank you. Mr. Christensen?
Here.
Dr. Davis? Dr. Edmonds? Mr. Evans? Dr. Fernandez?
Here.
Mr. Gilliland?
Present.
Mr. Guzman?
Honored to be here.
Ms. Le Nguyen?
Here.
Mayor March? Ms. Morris?
Present.
Mr. Mulrath?
Present.
Dr. Navarrete?
Present.
Dr. Palmer? Ms. Perna?
Here.
Ms. Prophet? Dr. Robinson?
Here.
Ms. Rodriguez? Ms. Royce? Oh, thank you. Ms. Royce?
Here.
Mr. Venuya? Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Winter. Item number three is Chair's report. First, I'd like to say thank you to everybody who submitted their input on the presidential search profile. I think that the finished product was excellent, and I appreciate all of the input that was given to us on that. Also, I was hoping to give Chancellor Rose just a few minutes to walk us through the current status of the search and where we are. And I also see Carlos and Gary from AGB on as well. So welcome. And Chancellor Rose, please give us an update.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee.
I apologize for the interruption. This is Yvonne Navarro-Smithson for the record. I just noticed that we skipped public comment.
Oh, I'm very sorry. You are right.
Apologies.
I'm glad you're here because that's very important. Winter, do we have any public comment?
Thank you, Madam Chair. We have two public comment submissions. One is an audio for our voicemail, and one is an online form that I'll read into the record. SCS, if you could play the audio.
For the record, Laura Nauman, N as in Nancy, A U M as in Mary, A N N, Faculty Senate Chair at Nevada State College and Associate Professor of Psychology. Good morning, Regents and Advisory Committee members. I'm making public comment today to express my support for having the Presidential Search Committee undergo anti-bias training before reviewing and ranking candidates. I'm particularly passionate about this for two reasons. First, I'm a psychologist who teaches my students how unconscious biases shape our perceptions of others and can impact our behavior and decision making. Second, as a faculty of color, I'm heartened by the explicit efforts of the system to make a commitment to equity in hiring practices. Inclusion of this training helps move from talking the talk to walking the walk. And now if you'll indulge me for a quick exercise that I conduct with my students. I'm going to read two sentences that describe the scenario. Listen carefully and then make an interpretation of the scenario. I'll read it twice. A boy goes fishing with his dad, but slips on a rock and suffers from a horrible head injury. When the ambulance arrives at the emergency room, the doctor there turns pale and exclaims, "Oh my God, it's my son." Second reading. A boy goes fishing with his dad, but slips on a rock and suffers from a horrible head injury. When the ambulance arrives at the emergency room, the doctor there turns pale and exclaims, "Oh my God, it's my son." Do you know the correct interpretation, or are you perplexed? How you responded to the scenario reveals something about your learned association for doctors. If you were wondering how the dad who was on the fishing trip with his son also managed to be surprised to see his son at the hospital, you have a strong association that doctors are male. If you were initially confused but eventually realized that the doctor was his mom, your unconscious automatically concluded male, but with a little time, you consciously and intentionally corrected your brain's automatic bias. There is one other interpretation, but even if you thought the son had two dads, your interpretation still indicates a strong association that doctors are male, not female. This example illustrates that many of us have been socialized to develop learned associations for a wide variety of roles and social identities. For example, we expect that women should be warm and nurturing, so we respond more negatively if they exhibit dominance and assertiveness. We often praise candidates of color for their eloquence or articulacy without acknowledging that our surprise stems from a learned association that people of color are perceived as less competent. As your training will illustrate, these biases manifest themselves in many ways, both during candidate review and during interviews. Your challenge will be to develop the awareness of how unconscious bias operates and become vigilant to interrupt those biases when you see them, both in yourself and in your fellow committee members. I know this content can be challenging, but I am confident in the committee's dedication to equity. I wish the committee success in the upcoming candidate review. Thank you.
The next public comment submission is from Christina Caputo. Since our campus model entails a joint academic and student affairs framework, it is important that we identify candidates who have a strong foundation in both faculty and staff affairs. For example, ideal candidates would demonstrate direct experience with faculty culture, teaching at a teaching institution, and direct experience in leading administrative services. Furthermore, candidates should exhibit direct involvement in executing equity-based policies and decisions regarding the enrollment, engagement, and retention of a diverse student body. Madam Chair, that is all the public comment we have at this time. Thank you.
You Winter, apologies for skipping right over public comment. I don't know why I did that, but anyway, thank you for that. And then we'll go back to the chair's report. So, Chancellor Rose, I'll turn it over to you. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Regents, and members of the Ad Hoc Advisory Committee. Melody Rose, Chancellor, for the record. And I've been asked by Chairwoman Carvalho to give you a brief update on the status of the search. And I have been, of course, working closely with Gary and Carlos as they have been using their extensive networks and also, of course, our advertising platforms to surface candidates and encourage them to complete their applications. And I'm just delighted to tell you that as of last night, we had 91 completed applications for the presidency of Nevada State College, which is a very robust pool. I'm not at all surprised, but very pleased that there has been a very significant and positive response to our call for candidates. And as importantly, I requested some data on the demographics of those who have completed their applications. And I think particularly in light of today's conversation, it will be heartening to share some of what we know about this pool at a high level. So the applicants to this position were given the option of completing a demographic survey and identifying themselves in a number of ways. And to date, and I think this number will increase over time, but to date, of the 91 applications, 36 individuals have provided their demographic identities for the use in, you know, high level look at the pool. So of those 36 who have responded with their demographic information, we find that 26 identify as men, 10 identify as women. That, by the way, doesn't surprise me. If anyone is wondering why the men so greatly outnumber the women, I think across the country and presidencies and chancellorships, it is still uncommon to see women rise to these positions. So that's probably reflective of the larger condition of the academy. Very positive information is that, again, among those 36 who provided their identities, 15 self-identified as white and 21 identified as people of color. So that is a tremendous result, I would tell you. And if those numbers hold, to have more candidates, self-identified candidates of color than white candidates would be quite remarkable and uncommon in such searches. And so I have to thank Carlos and Gary for hearing this committee, for hearing the campus and learning from them what kinds of diversity we were eager to see in the pool. And I'm very pleased to tell you, I have been reviewing the materials. 91 dossiers is a lot to read. And so I have been perusing them as they've come in. And I just would tell you, they are remarkably skilled, prepared. And I think that it will make for some tough decisions as we go through the next phases, because the pool is so strong. And just to give you a sense of that timeline, we do have semifinal interviews scheduled for April 8th and 9th. That's 2 weeks from now. And so between now and then, I will be working with our consultants to narrow that pool from 91 or wherever we end up down to a reasonable number of individuals that we can interview in 2 days. So I look forward to that work ahead. It will, based on what I've seen in the applicant pool, there will be some really tough decisions, because we're blessed with an incredible applicant pool. And I think that's about all I can report at this point, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Chancellor Rose, for that update. I think that that's some very positive, encouraging news. So thank you for sharing that with us. I guess I was in such a rush to get started on our great training today that I skipped over not just public comment, but also approving the minutes. So I apologize for taking everything out of order. But we'll go back to item number two, which is approving the minutes of the meeting from January 29th. Regent Del Carlo, did you have something?
Yes, I make a motion to approve the minutes as written for January 29th.
Second.
Thank you. And second from Regent Perkins. Thank you, Vice Chair Del Carlo. Oh my gosh, I'm a mess today. It's Friday, so forgive me for all of the mistakes I've made already. Okay, is there any other discussion regarding minutes? Okay, then we will just go ahead and take a voice vote. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 All those opposed? Any abstentions? Okay, motion carries. Thank you. Okay, now we will go back to item number four, which is the anti-bias awareness and managing the selection process training. So we have Ms. Shannon Cambridge and Dr. Kim Bobby with AGB here with us today to conduct the training. I know that this training is normally held in person, and we've had to adjust, obviously, because of the current circumstances. So we will, I will turn it over to Ms. McCambridge and Dr. Bobby. Thank you for being here today.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair. And could you please remind me of the name of the individual who is our tech person and who will be doing our PowerPoint?
I believe that would be Winter, unless Winter has, Winter will have somebody else doing it, but I believe it's Winter.
Okay, and Winter has, I should tell you, Yvonne and Winter have been tremendously helpful to us. So a special thanks to Yvonne and Winter. And Winter, could you please put our presentation up? starting with slide one? Thank you. Thank you so much. Well, good morning, everyone. Kim and I are very grateful to be here with all of you today, and we'd like to welcome everyone to this workshop. This is a very exciting time for you as you move to the next phase of your presidential search. And as Chancellor Rose explained, you are definitely off to a great start. Having 91 candidates is indeed a huge success in presidential searches. Although we would typically start by asking everyone to introduce themselves, obviously, that won't work in this remote setting, and it would also be too time-consuming, because Kim and I are very hopeful that we will have time at the end of this presentation to have some dialogue and answer any questions. However, we know that this is a room full of tremendously talented individuals, and we look forward to getting to know you better, not through the introductions, but instead through the three exercises, group exercises that we have planned. So with that, I will start with a brief introduction of myself and then turn it over to Kim Bobby. So by background, I am an employment law attorney. Most of my career was in the employment law department of a large law firm. Excuse me. Much of my work included advising clients on best practices in the selection process, addressing discrimination issues, and obviously litigating and mediating workplace issues in state and federal court. Throughout my career, I also taught graduate and undergraduate employment law classes at three universities. And like many of you on this call, I have served on a governing board. I served on the board of trustees at Gonzaga University for 16 years, and I chaired both the Academic Policy Committee and the Governance Committee and sat on a number of other committees, and now am an emeritus trustee member of Gonzaga's board. At the AGB, I have a dual role. The first role, I serve as a full-time executive search consultant, focusing primarily on presidential searches in the private sector. I also serve as a consultant providing training for AGB's clients. In that capacity, I work with boards of regents and boards of trustees in building effective governance practices. And approximately 4 years ago, at the request of firm clients, I started an anti-bias training workshop that I would typically provide to clients during the search process, similar to how you're receiving your training today. And last spring, Kim, Bobby, and I joined forces in that work. Kim has spent a lifetime in this area, and she is a true authority. So I will now turn it over to Dr. Bobby, my esteemed colleague, for her to introduce herself. Kim? I think you might be on mute. Winter, can you double check to see if you can unmute Kim?
Yeah, let's see what we can do here. I think that it looks like they're working on it.
Okay. Let me see if she texts me. Winter, we hear you walking away.
Oh, I think that might be somebody else. Can everybody please make sure that they are on mute except for Dr. Bobby? And I don't think we can hear you yet. I'm sorry. We are working on it. Can you check it? Yeah, we still aren't unable to hear you.
In the interest of time, while we wait for Kim, maybe you could advance to slide 3 and then we'll go back to slide 2. This must just be one of those days where life is out of order, Madam Chair, because this is happening to us too. So let me just first highlight some of the coaching objectives. The workshop training objectives are set forth on this slide, but essentially we have two goals. The first is to raise awareness about diversity, equity, and inclusion with a focus on understanding bias. And then the second goal is to provide some practical steps that you can take as you move into the candidate evaluation phase to recognize and reduce bias. And this is all designed to preserve the integrity of the search process, to promote diversity, equity, and inclusion, and truthfully, just to ensure that you have overall fairness in your search. And now I'll go back to see if we were able to link Kim in. The update, Winter.
I think the tech person that's working on this is James, and okay. I know that they are still working on it.
Hi, Chair Carvalho. This is Winter. We don't see her on right now, so I think she needs to click the link and re-enter.
We see her. I see her on my screen. I just don't hear her.
She just got in, I'm being told, so now we're working on the sound.
Thank you. Okay, it looks like she's muted. Maybe try to unmute again. No, we still can't hear you.
No, I have an idea. She may be able to access by phone and not have video, but I'm not sure. I think she would have to go back out and then come back in. Is that right, James?
Hi, this is Winter again. I'm going to send her the call-in number right now.
Okay.
That's perfect. Thank you. And then, James, could you please go to slide number 2? So one more. Yes. Perfect. And I have to tell you, this is actually a picture of Nevada. And we have Kim will be speaking to about the people in the whole journey, the history of equality and how we're all on this journey together. But I will leave that for Kim because she's brilliant at her dialogue. But this is a beautiful picture of Nevada, so I had to include it in the slides. Thank you for everyone's patience.
Yes, thank you to everybody. We're unfortunately that's the way things go right now with technology. Sometimes is patience is a virtue right now.
That's right.
Yes. So hopefully we can get Dr. Bobby back on. Okay, I just got a note that we're just waiting for her to connect again. Hopefully this time will work.
Perfect.
We see you again, Dr. Bobby, but we can't hear you. We suspect that perhaps your microphone is muted, but I'm sure you've tried everything on there.
I have another idea.
Okay.
Kim could call my cell phone and I could put her on speaker.
Okay, we can do that. I mean, she can stay on the screen and call in. That we can try that.
So do you think she can, has, Kim, give a thumbs up if you've tried to call in to the Nevada site. Test track. This sounds very hopeful.
That was perfect.
Does it look like she's giving you a call? It looks like she's trying to call you.
Okay.
Or call somebody. Maybe I'm wrong on that. I don't know. While we're waiting, perhaps we could, since we thought that we weren't going to have time for introductions, perhaps we can, we did do introductions at our last meeting very quickly, but maybe we could do that again while Dr. Bobby is trying to connect. Perhaps we could do that. I've gotten a suggestion that maybe that would be helpful. So let's see. So we have regents and we have advisory members who are part of the committee. And so for regents, I'm obviously the chair of the committee. I'm a regent on the Board of Regents. We have Dr. Patrick Carter. I don't believe he's on the phone right now. Also, vice chair of the board is Carol Del Carlo. She's also on the committee with us. And Regent Kathy McAdoo is also with us today. Oh, yes, I think we can.
Yes.
Okay. Well, then maybe
okay.
We'll jump right in then. Thank you for working with us, and thank you to everybody for being patient. I think we'll just move on and get right into the heart of your discussion. So thank you.
Ooh, thank you all. I'm so sorry. I don't know what is going on. I turned my computer completely off and back on, and it still didn't fix it. So thank you for your patience.
Thank you.
Okay. So we're on slide 2. That's where we are.
We're on slide 2, and then, Kim, you go immediately into slide 4. I already did slide 3.
Okay. So we all know that this is a journey, right? This work is important. Creating a culture of inclusiveness and equity is an ongoing journey, and we must remain vigilant in this work personally, interpersonally, and organizationally. So when we look at slide 4, we wanted to examine what it means to have true diversity, inclusion, and equity. And diversity is ever present. You know, diversity is natural in the world and in a human species, right? And in species. We have inclusion when we bring everyone into the room equally, and we share power, and we share influence, and we share voice. And in order to create a sense of belonging, we also have to have equity. And equity, equality, and justice are very different. As you can see from this image in the middle, you know, equality means that, you know, the assumption is that everyone benefits from the same support in the same way, right? Equity means everyone gets support they need, but justice means no barrier should be there, and everyone should be able to access, you know, the opportunity based on their own merit and their own ability to see clearly, and that is represented in leveling the playing field. No matter where you stand, you should be able to stand on your own 2 feet, and justice should be there so that you could access all the opportunities equally. And that's what we want to emphasize in the search and selection process for the candidates. Next slide. So now we're going to have a brief discussion. You know what? And I'm going to ask you these questions, and I hope this will be interactive, because that's really what this work is about, is creating a safe space to be authentic in your voice, be in a space where we can all think out loud and come to conclusion and share and grow in this space. We talk about diversity, equity, inclusion, and any concerns we may have. So what does diversity look like to you? Have you ever stopped to think about that? We all have our sphere of influence, and we all have our own circles and our circles of trust. And when we think about that, what does diversity look like to you? Anyone?
Can we have this is Carol. I'll start. This is Carol. I think diversity to me is just, it's a representative of the population where you are. Like in the United States, it would be, we're a melting pot. So it's all the different nationalities, men, women, transgender, it's all those people coming together, either in a meeting, a room, or demographics, whatever. It's not just one homogeneous culture, unless you're in maybe a country in Africa that doesn't have any diversity.
Oh, really?
Well, I'm just thinking like a tribe that's never seen the outside world. I get National Geographic, and they've never seen outsiders in that one tribe. But I mean, the world today is extremely diverse.
So, anyone else want to jump in there?
I guess Regent Perkins here. I guess I can jump in, if that's okay, Madam Chair.
yes, go ahead.
Diversity, thank you. Diversity to me means anybody that's different from myself. Anybody that comes from different family structure, different race, creed, color, different housing track. Anybody that has any. We're all people, but people that are different from like what I am used to, what is in my inner circle, expanding my inner circle is diversity.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Someone else.
Hi, this is Lori Navarrete, Dr. Navarrete from NSC. And when I think of diversity, I think of all the wonderful different languages we hear in lots of different contexts.
Okay. Keep going.
So this is Eric. I would add in all of the pieces, but I would also add in, I like to focus on diversity of thought and knowing that there may be folks that have different ways of doing things that maybe isn't historical to the, well, we're in higher ed, so historical to higher ed. So I like to include diversity of thought in that discussion as well.
Okay. Others?
This is Regent McAdoo, and I think that anytime I'm with somebody, even one person and me, there's the great possibility of diversity there. I agree with all the comments that have been made about what make us diverse, but typically when we are with someone else other than in our own head or our own heart, there's going to be some sort of diversity there.
Mm-hmm. others.
I would echo what others have said, that diversity really means difference, difference of opinion, difference of culture, difference of anything that you can think of, just being aware of the differences between the people in the group or the organization, or like somebody mentioned, just even two people. It's embracing that there are differences.
Mm-hmm. Okay, absolutely. So now let's shift to equity. So we've kind of unpacked diversity, right? So what does equity, when you hear that, what do you think about, what does equity feel like? What does equity look like?
Hi, this is Mike Barton. I'm with the local school system. And I think we look at equity as there's systemic obstacles that have been around for years, sort of shunts in the system that have been systemic in nature, really holding back students in our system. And so they've been designed that way for centuries, if not decades. So how does a system tackle those systemic barriers so that students can thrive?
To add on to that, Regent Perkins, I think equity is having an equal opportunity to succeed. So almost exactly what Mr. Barton said, giving people the tools that they need to be successful is pretty much, that's what I consider equity.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
This is Evie. I'll also add that for me, it's about action. So it's a commitment to challenging discrimination, harassment, bias. So equity for me is about action, individual action, collective action, institutional action, and to call things out.
Mm-hmm. Others, go ahead.
Chair Carvalho, this is Chancellor Rose. I think about it as getting the supports that you need. And so I think back to my days as a young faculty member at Portland State and learning that no woman had ever received tenure before in my department. And so we looked at some of the reasons why and eventually sought a policy change for a stop the clock policy for parents in general, and I was very proud to help bring that about. And of course, that was the support that young parents needed in order to compete with others in the tenure review process. So maybe that's a specific higher ed example mm-hmm. of a policy change that for me as a young mom way back then felt like responsive to my particular needs.
Mm-hmm. That's good. Other examples.
This is Lori, again, from Nevada State College, and I was thinking about when we work in training teachers to work with students with disabilities, that I talk to my students about equity in terms of giving students what they each need to level the playing field, that it's not equal. Everyone doesn't need the same thing. Everyone doesn't need the same accommodations, but some students do in order for them to be on the same field. So equity is not necessarily equal, is not mm-hmm. equal necessarily.
Others.
Hello, this is Dr. Tynika Davis. And I like the last comment that was made regarding equity not meaning equal, but equity being having ownership and, you know, resources that are available to diverse populations and making sure that those resources are accessible for those with those diverse backgrounds.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Someone else.
I would echo what Adit said about action, that there's action involved in leveling the playing field, no matter what it is making sure that everybody has that same opportunity and access to whether it's higher education, healthcare, whatever it may be, but that's that action that's involved with that.
Mm-hmm. Any other examples that come to mind?
I guess Regent Perkins here. A very simple example. When my children were younger, they wanted the same things. Like they both needed shoes. But when they said, "Oh, mommy, you don't treat us equally," I would say, "Well, do you want both size? Do you want to wear your sister's size shoes, or do you want your sister to wear your size shoes? But both of you have shoes, so that's equity. If both of you have shoes, that's equity. But equal would be giving you." Each a size 8 when knowing one's a 7 and one's a 6, equally mm-hmm. giving each child the same shoe. That's equal, but that's not equity because it's not behooving the student. It's not behooving the person. It's not helping them get to where they need to be or where they want to be. So that's like a very simple example when my children were younger that I had to explain the difference between equal and equity.
So let's shift to inclusion then. So now we've kind of unpacked diversity, we've unpacked equity somewhat. Let's talk about inclusion and what does inclusion mean to you?
Hi, I'm sorry. I couldn't figure out how to raise my hand. This is NSSA Junior Senator Rodriguez. To me, inclusion is by far one of the most important aspects. Inclusion to me is not only tolerance, but the acceptance and welcoming of anyone who is different than you in any way.
Others?
Sorry, I was going to say, this is Jennifer Edmonds at Nevada State. I do think of inclusion. I just wanted to follow up on that last comment. I see this with my children as well. Feeling comfortable being who you are in a conversation, not judged, feeling like you can express your opinions as long as they're respectful of others.
Mm-hmm. Others, an example. What does it feel like to you? What does it mean to you, inclusion?
This is Avid. I think in our higher ed setting, Nevada State works really hard to create a sense of belonging for its students. So we may recruit the students, they may enroll, but if we don't create a sense of belonging on the campus, mm-hmm. they're not going to feel included.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, this is Jamie.
Mm-hmm.
I think for me, thinking about inclusion really is about looking at the space around us and thinking about whose voices and whose perspectives are heard and whose aren't, right? And thinking about, like, how do we ensure that everyone has a seat at the table? We might disagree, but that everyone has a seat at the table. So an example I can think of recently is I attended a conference, and one of the sessions was on the impact of COVID-19 on, like, education, right? And this Native scholar was talking about one of the Navajo, I think we all know, have been like the most severely impacted by COVID, right? Had submitted to all of these panels and not been included in any of them. So the only opportunity to speak about the issue was during Q&A. And so we might think about inclusion, like, you know, who has a seat at the table, who's impacted, and why is it important to think about the issue from a perspective that's often left out?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Others we haven't heard from. Or if you have anything to say, I was just trying to bring some more, be inclusive and call some more voices to the table.
This is Mike again. I just tend to think of the word access with inclusion sort of being mm-hmm. synonymous, especially with, an example would be special education children having inclusive practices where in the mainstreamed environment, being exposed to the general education curriculum versus being, 30 years ago, they were in different classes, never having that access. or advanced placement in high school, where historically it's been Caucasian students who have had access to advanced placement. So making sure students of color have that same access or inclusion to higher education or advanced curriculum.
This is Eric again. I would say having the ability and willingness to recognize and welcome those that may be different from us. And I think that's where a lot of folks fail, is they don't have the ability or willingness to do that. And without that, inclusion can't occur. Hence the training we're going through today.
This is Regent Carter. So I think of diversity and equity as things, you know, we're getting the students into the institution. When we get to the inclusion part, that's where we're having to help them and it's the real action of keeping them and helping build resilience and getting them to be successful. So having great equity and diversity and getting people onto the campus is the first part. But then once they're there, we have to make sure that they're included and that they're successful on our campuses.
This is Regent McAdoo again, and I think inclusion is removing a sense of less than for people who are with us, whether it's on campus, in a classroom, wherever it is, so that they literally feel a part and that it's fair and impartial.
To extend some of the things that have already been said, I just wanted to say, I think in teacher training, I think of inclusion as academic inclusion, social inclusion, leisure inclusion, lunch inclusion. I mean, inclusion doesn't just happen in a vacuum or in a space. It's a safe space in all of those experiences. And I would also say, when I think of including kids with disabilities, and in this case, that's my area of expertise, but in the general classroom, it's not only about getting our kids with disabilities prepared and to understand ways that they can make it easier for themselves to be included, but it's also really important that their typical peers also understand how to, you know, the training needs to happen on both sides. So, you know, acceptance, understanding of belief, understanding of difference, and feeling comfortable with that. So it's a process of facilitation.
So let's shift that from the classroom to, you know, to the boardroom. Let's shift our focus. Inclusion, diversity, equity, inclusion, and leadership. What does that look like? What comes to mind?
Well, I'll start us off. This is Regent Carter. But I think when you think about that applied to the boardroom, you have to establish an environment that the board is willing to listen and accept diverse points of view. And I think that kind of goes in with all three of those things.
Others?
Regent McAdoo, I think it also, I honestly feel like we might be experiencing that even in our meeting, because I know there are some really, well, I believe everybody on the call has thoughts and opinions about this. And I've now spoken three times, and I don't tend to do that again, because I think to include means that your opinion, your thought, how you do things should not feel intimidating all the time.
Someone else.
I'll add that in, I recall in California, the governor put into law that any, I think it's corporate boards had to have a female or have to have a female on their board. And so it's not just saying, oh, you're welcome and come, but we have to challenge systems, make corrections, in order to have that inclusion. So that's what comes to mind.
This is Jamie again. I think we also have to unpack like what comes to our mind when we think of leader. I do an exercise with my students about that, and they have a really hard time thinking of leaders who are, you know, of minority backgrounds, whether it's, you know, queer leaders or women leaders or people of color leaders, like to really think about that. And so if we kind of have this, like, because we're all socialized in this society, is that one monolithic idea of who a leader is, but we might not be about looking at the actual skills that we're looking for, right? And the leadership style that we actually want to see. We might be kind of falling into what we've been shown as a leader. And so I think, you know, sociologist in me is like, we always want to lay those things on the ground. We want to say, like, what leadership style do we want to see? You know, what are the qualities we really want to see? And really look for those things rather than just kind of see, like, look at the person and say, oh, that's what I think is a leader, right? That fits with my preconceived assumption.
I'll share two comments. One is to ensure that the board has a means of drawing out the voices of people who tend to be more quiet. And secondly, to review their policies to ensure that they don't have policies that are inadvertently discouraging women or underrepresented minorities from joining the board.
And also, it's important when, you know, inclusion should be bringing people into leadership roles by acknowledging that they are more than one identity and that they might be someone from a marginalized group or, you know, have social identities that are typically that are most notably, you know, discriminated against. They bring a full person. They're intersectionality of identity. Everyone has them. And so when we talk about inclusion and equity, that means in order to get to the sense of belonging, you have to be mindful of the whole person. And all of us are more than just one thing, right? So true inclusion means including the whole person. And equity means sharing power, okay? So when, you know, if there's not a space where who's inviting someone, if you have to be invited, who's the inviter and who's the guest? You know, everyone should be able to enter the space as equal if you have true inclusion, right? So any other concerns about this when it comes to the search and selection process around diversity, equity, and inclusion?
Regent Perkins here. My concern is that we all say that we want diversity, equity, inclusion, but then our actions don't match what we say. That's my general concern. I mean, I'll leave it there. I'll just drop that there. that's one of my concerns.
Thank you. Someone else?
I think that what you said about equity as sharing power is very meaningful to me. I think sometimes leadership happens in a silo type of setting, and leadership is best done when it's collaborative and more than one idea comes to the table. And so actively thinking about that shared power and that sense of getting more than one voice to the table is really important.
Others. So we say we want diversity, equity, inclusion, but what stops us? You know, there's some concerns there. It doesn't play out. What stops us from achieving that in the leadership space?
I think mostly denial. Most people don't believe that they have those tendencies or those biases that, I guess it was said earlier about the unconscious, the implicit biases that I guess we don't call them, we don't call ourselves out enough, or we don't question why we make that decision enough, and we don't self-examine enough to make those changes and to see that they are systemic and acknowledge them. I think acknowledgement is the first part of trying to push these agendas forward.
Oh, this is Eric. I would add, I think there's also a level of fear that folks have to acknowledge their biases, that, well, if I acknowledge this, it means I'm a bad person. And instead of saying understanding we all have biases, there's not one of us that doesn't. So being comfortable in ourself to be able to acknowledge our deficiencies there and open the door to be able to work on those.
Mm-hmm. Any other concerns about this?
Well, I'd like to add that again, this is Jennifer Edmonds. I've seen a lot of leaders who aren't transparent in their decision-making, and they don't lean on their close colleagues to help navigate some of those decisions. Because as soon as you start asking others' opinions, then that's when you might see some of your own implicit biases being recognized. So I get concerned about leaders who are so confident in their own point of view that they forget to ask for advice and counsel.
Okay. I think this has been a good discussion. And I think it leads us right into the next slide, Shannon, about understanding bias. I think you all started to kind of go into that space.
Thank you, Kim. Yeah, great discussion, not only enlightening, but very heartfelt. So like Nevada State College, an important priority throughout higher education over the last few years especially has been to increase diversity. However, in spite of the best intentions of individuals and institutions, we all know that higher education is basically not as diverse as it hopes to be. Some people think that unconscious bias in the selection process may be partly to blame. Therefore, our goal is to really learn more about managing bias. And the first step in managing bias is educating ourselves about it, why it exists, and basically what to do about it. So what exactly is bias? Generally, as this slide shows, there are two types of bias. On one hand, there is the explicit, the expressed bias that is a conscious preference, positive or negative, for a particular social group. And to be an explicit bias, it must be intentional or deliberate. It's an example would be overt racism. On the other hand, is implied or implicit bias. And this is the unconscious bias that we all have that flies under the radar of our conscious awareness. It's generally defined as an unconscious association, belief, or attitude towards any social group, and it results in these rapid-fire association and assumptions, our mental shortcuts in thinking that are based on a lifetime of different experiences and associations. To better understand why we have bias and how they work, let's review a brief video. And if you could please advance to the next slide, James, thank you, and activate this video.
Implicit bias.
2016 was the year that implicit bias went somewhat mainstream.
Yeah, so when Hillary Clinton mentioned implicit bias in the debates, our phones started blowing up, all our friends started emailing us about it.
But what is implicit bias? Implicit biases are basically thought processes that happen without you even knowing it. Little mental shortcuts that hold judgments you might not agree with. And sometimes the shortcuts are based on race. First, some clarity. Saying someone has an implicit bias is different from calling someone a racist.
The word racist is a highly loaded term, right, here in American society. A lot of times, when people are using it, they're thinking of the kind of old-fashioned Ku Klux Klan-style racist.
But implicit bias isn't anywhere near that, you know, explicit.
Implicit bias is something that comes out of ordinary mental functioning, out of how the mind normally works.
We've all grown up in a culture with
media images, news images, conversations we heard at home, our education. Think of that as a fog we've been breathing our whole life. We've never even realized it, what we were taking in.
And that fog causes associations that lead to biases.
I somehow know that if you say peanut butter, I'm going to say jelly. That's an association that's been ingrained in me because throughout my life, peanut butter and jelly are together. And in many forms of media, there's an overrepresentation of Black men and violent crime being paired together.
And because of that, I actually deep down inside have been taught that Black men are violent and aggressive and not to be trusted, that they're criminals, that they're thugs.
With all those associations, I'm not trying to let us off the hook, but in some ways, none of us stood a chance.
Starting today, we'll post a video a day dealing with one challenge of understanding implicit bias and its relationship to race and exploring ways we might combat the problem.
One more thing. If you're seeing this and thinking that it doesn't apply to you, well, you might be falling prey to the blind spot bias. That's the scientific name for a mental bias that allows you to see biases in others, but not in yourself. We're biased.
Thank you, James. Could you go to slide 8? Thank you. One comment before going into an overview of a legal summary is that you can take the implicit association test online. I don't know if anyone has done that, but it's a computer-based test that provides you very quick results and an assessment of your own individual biases that I think is pretty good. As the video explained, our brains are so bombarded by so much information that there's a natural tendency to quickly sort the information and categorize the information that's received, and that this is where our brain makes those instantaneous judgments so that we can navigate worlds more efficiently. But unfortunately, it is often when the brain is making these instantaneous judgments that the risk of unconscious bias creeps into our decision making. And this can not only create an obvious barrier to creating diversity, but it also can result in discriminatory decision-making. As you all know, there are a number of local, state, and federal laws, anti-discrimination laws, that create basically a patchwork protection for candidates and employees. This slide highlights a number of those laws. And then, James, will you please go to the next slide? Clearly, one of the most important pieces of anti-discrimination legislation is the Civil Rights Act of 1964. In the interest of time, I'm only going to highlight the protected class under Title VII and a recent change in the law before moving on to the state of Nevada's equivalent of the Civil Rights Act or Title VII. Under Title VII, the protected classes are groups of people who share a common trait who are legally protected from being discriminated against on the basis of that trait include race, color, religion, and sex, which has been expanded to include pregnancy, sexual orientation, or gender identity, national origin, age, defined as 40 or older, disability, genetic information. So all of those people are in a protected class. And it's also illegal to retaliate against anyone on the basis of them bringing a discrimination claim based on those classes. Let's quickly review a recent change in federal law in the area of sexual orientation. This change was the result of a landmark decision of the Supreme Court last June in a case entitled Bostock versus Clayton County. And in that case, a woman named Amy Stevens, a funeral home worker who presented as well, was diagnosed with gender dysphoria. Before taking a vacation, Ms. Stevens informed her bosses at the funeral home that she intended to transition and live as a woman when she returned from vacation. As a result, the funeral home fired her immediately. Therefore, she brought a discrimination claim against the funeral home, and the issue before the Supreme Court was whether Title VII of the Civil Rights Act, which outlaws employment discrimination on the basis of sex, should also cover transgender status and sexual orientation. And the court held for the first time that, yes, it should be expanded to include that definition. This was really perceived as a landmark case for civil rights, especially for the diverse communities. But so now sex under Title VII is construed more broadly to include transgender and sexual orientation. And James, could you please go to the next slide? Now we're going to look at the civil rights laws under the state of Nevada. As you know, all states have anti-discrimination laws related to employment. Many states are substantially similar to the Civil Rights Act under federal law, and this is especially true with regard to the state of Nevada. So these are the protected classes under Nevada law. Are, in other words, it is unlawful to treat anyone differently because of their race, national origin, religion, etc. Let's look at a few of the less subtle examples of discrimination that can arise from bias in the selection process under Nevada law. And I'm going to specifically focus on race. An increasingly common example of bias that can lead to discrimination during the search process occurs when a candidate is not considered or advanced because the individual's name is associated with being a member of a certain race. There is substantial and credible research that shows candidates with names like Jamal, Jose, Deshaun are less likely than their counterparts with white-sounding names like John, Garrett, Sam, to be advanced to the interview stage of a search. Studies show that it was the names and their associated biases that influenced the decision-making, not the competency or the experience or skills of the candidates. So in a comprehensive study, while race is the primary factor influencing these prejudicial views, these biases were also influenced by other identity markers, such as nationality. In the interest of time, I'm going to jump down to gender identity and expression, simply because this is an area in which we typically receive a lot of questions as to the distinction between gender identity and gender expression. Gender identity is typically defined as an individual's innate sense of their own gender, sometimes described as a deeply held sense, a psychological acknowledgement or understanding of one's own gender, regardless of the gender that was assigned to them at birth. It's an all-encompassing phrase. It may include male, female, a combination of male, female, neither male or female, or transgender. The term gender expression typically focuses on a person's gender-related appearance or expression. In other words, characteristics or behavior of a person that are different from the typical social expectations of that person's sex assigned to them at birth. So it's important to recognize that gender identity and gender expression are both protected under the law. And now I think it actually is time for our 10-minute break. Yes, it is. We've been going over an hour. Unless you have any questions at this point on those legal categories, I think we'll move to a 10-minute break.
Okay, we will do that. So we'll come back at 10:20. Thank you, everybody. All right, well, it's 10:20, so I think we can start up again if you are both ready.
Yes, we are.
Sounds great. And Kim, you are up on slide 12.
Yes. Okay. So is everyone back? Okay, we'll go ahead and get started and honor those who are here on time. So this discussion about bias, we know, as the video pointed out, that we all have biases. And practicing thinking about what we're thinking is how we become conscious of those biases. So now let's talk about our own biased thoughts. We all have them. And that's a part of this experience as a committee, you know, really putting yourself out there and sharing that we all have these biases. So anyone want to share a bias that you may have caught yourself applying in your life? Now that we've been thinking about this. Any thoughts, any biased thoughts that you have caught yourself?
I'll start, but remember, this is a no judge zone, right?
Thank you.
So as a scientist, we sometimes judge harshly on scientific writing that is where the grammar and the, where it's obvious that the authors are not English as a first language speakers, and so they've struggled with their writing. And so we'll sometimes not look as highly on a work of science simply because the writing isn't as polished and beautiful as it needs to look, even though it has absolutely nothing to do with the quality of the science itself. So I think that probably dribbles over into also maybe just talking to scientists at an international meeting. If I'm having a hard time communicating with them because of our language barrier, I may in my mind kind of, unintentionally not think as highly of them as scientists simply because we're just having a hard time communicating.
Thank you. Thank you for getting us started and being vulnerable in this space. That's what we have to do in this work. This is human work. We have to share as humans and create that culture. And so what you're doing now in this committee is you're creating that culture. Someone else.
This is Mike. I think often I judge millennials. I just have to, are there any millennials on the call today? I want to be fair that sometimes I view them, I'm just going to be honest, that or I read some of the research and have to correct my thoughts that they lack commitment to organizations, that they're, 3 to 5 years max, and they're going to move on somewhere else, that they potentially lack purpose at times. They've been described as lazy. But then you talk to millennials and they're bright and they have aspirations. But I think sometimes I fall into that trap that millennials are, going to drive Uber for 5 years and do some part-time gigs versus commit to an organization. Mm-hmm. Sorry if you're a millennial, by the way. I apologize for that.
But now you're aware of it, and so you're correcting for it. That's what this is all about. All of us have biases. Someone else.
Well, again, if this is a no judgment safe space, I'll share an example that actually happened on my run this morning. Running with my running partner, and there's this older gentleman that we see all the time walking his dog. Super pleasant, nice guy. And I made a comment. I said, I wonder if he has a wife. And my running partner said, well, he could have a husband. And it was like, you're right. So, yeah, the irony of that coming up this morning, right before the anti-bias training.
Mm-hmm. Others.
This is Regent McMichael. I have a bias, and I tend to flaunt it because I'm a retired military, and I spend a great deal of time out at the military base. So I'm surrounded by military people, and my bias is when I get out into the public, I actually look around to see if there are any people wearing veterans cap or military uniform so that I can feel a little bit more comfortable. That is my bias.
Mm-hmm. And others?
I was thinking of something that I think you would call it a bias, that, you know, when you're a teenager, you think your parents don't know anything. And then when you become a parent of a teenager, you realize, wow, they're going to think that I don't know anything. And that when the tables are turned and you realize that as a teenager, you thought you knew everything. And then as a parent, you realize, you know, you may come across as knowing everything with your child, but you can learn a lot from children. I don't know if I said that necessarily in a very succinct way, but I was just thinking about how, you know, teenagers sometimes think their parents know nothing, you know, but as parents, we think we know everything.
Mm-hmm. Hi, this is Avi. Something that comes to mind is when we are reviewing applicants. Mm-hmm. In the instant, there's the judgment that an EDD is not as rigorous as a PhD, or in an instance, we judge someone who receives an online or for-profit degree somehow is not as rigorous as, let's say, a private institution or a well-known public institution, and we do it in a flash. Mm-hmm.
This is Eric. I'll share. I guess I probably had this bias, and I, you know, being in human resources, I've seen the bias, but looking at the way someone's dressed for an interview and immediately saying, well, if they're not in a suit and tie, they're not qualified, and not recognizing that maybe the person doesn't have the ability to have a suit and tie, or maybe they just dress in a different way, is absolutely a bias I have had and have seen frequently.
This is Regent McAdoo, and I experience biases many, many times when I happen to be in a store.
So let's stay on thoughts, though. We're going to go to your treatment, but let's go to bias thoughts that you might have. Okay.
Well, this is a biased thought. Oh,
okay.
So I was in the grocery store, and it was dark outside, and I needed to run there. And these three young men came in, and they had mohawks that were really, really high, and they had, baggy jeans. They had chains. They had all those things. And I saw them, and instantly I had this thought mm-hmm. of fear, like, ay, ay, ay. And then I realized, because I've taken anti-bias trainings before, and so it creates an awareness in me. So I thought, that's silly to be afraid of them. So I walked up to him and I said, hey, you guys, when I first saw you, you kind of looked scary. I said, but now I want to know how in the world you got your hair like that. I said, I'm only making that to my grandsons one of these days. And so they told me they did it with Elmer's glue. But which fascinated me totally. But anyway, it was really a biased thought. It's like I'm judging them. It's kind of the same thing the last gentleman said on what they were wearing and what they looked like. And mm-hmm. I think all three of these young men, I mean, they weren't young men of color, but I went right there really fast.
But you also caught yourself, and that's what we all have to try to work on, that muscle of saying, wait a minute, I don't have the facts. You know, wait a minute, I'm making I'm being biased here. That's really what we're trying to get at, what you just, the example right. you just gave of really
stopping. But I felt I had to address it with them in order for me to really deal with it in my own mind. Mm-hmm. Like, well, I'm just going to tell them that they looked scary. And then I had this wonderful conversation with them. So it helped me.
That's great. Others? Okay, so now we'll shift because, you know, we've all, and part of accessing this is in speaking into our own truths is that we all have felt bias in some form or another in our lives, right? So speaking into the other side of it, knowing how it feels. Anyone want to share any bias treatment that they might have been on the receiving end of?
This is Carol. I'll share one where I felt, you know, excluded and maybe discriminated against. I was at a week-long seminar when I worked for one of the large automobile companies, and we were in Detroit, Michigan, right downtown at the Rensen, having a week-long training session. And one of the new Spike Lee movies had come out that I was really interested in seeing. And a group of people that were of color were all talking and chattering about going. And they only invited the people of color in the room and no one else was invited. And I thought to myself, gosh, I didn't speak up because I didn't feel comfortable enough to do that. And these are some people that I had never met before, of course, because we were from all over the country for this seminar. But I just felt, don't they realize that I'm being excluded too? That I may have wanted to go, but so, I mean, it works from all people. We all have different biases. And I would have loved to have seen that movie with them, but that's an opportunity that I didn't get that time.
Yes, we all have biases. You're right. Someone else.
I guess my bias treatment is the one of choice is people pretend like they don't know the question I'm asking or what I'm saying because of the color of my skin, and they don't expect. I don't know why the past that. I don't know why, but that just that little microaggression thing that that's it happens on the constant. I mean, I can't give you just one example, but that is like the example of choice. People pretending that they don't know what I'm actually asking or saying. I have to rephrase it 3 or 4 times and it's,
I just had a conversation with Shannon about this. someone else?
This is Cheryl again. I'll share coming from nursing practice into academia and being referred to as a faculty that just has an MSN. Repeatedly is something that I felt devalued and kind of discriminated against. There were certain things that I couldn't be qualified for promotion, even though it appeared that I met criteria. So I think in academia, sometimes we have a lot of bias based on degree, title, position, power.
This is Eric. I'll share. I was a candidate for a institutional equity and Title IX position and was told by one of the committee members that they didn't think I could relate because I'm a white male, regardless of my over 10 years experience and personal journey related to that area. So that felt really awful, but use it as a learning experience to ensure that I personally didn't act in that manner towards any other person. And inform our search committees and our that are involved in the selection to do the same.
Good morning. This is Dr. Tynika Davis. And an experience that I remember or recall is when I started out as a bedside nurse, and I would get called into the room by a family member or a patient who I hadn't been able to introduce myself to, and I walk into the room and they ask me again, can they speak to the nurse? And when I explained to them that I am the nurse, that I often saw a shock or a surprise on their face that I was anything other than a housekeeper or a certified nursing assistant.
I'll add something. Outside of being a regent, I'm also a business owner, and I own businesses with my husband. But we are 100% equal partners in that. But often I've been referred to as the owner's wife, and I've had to tell people, no, I am just as much an owner as my husband is. And so that's been a difficulty for me in the past, and sometimes can be kind of awkward, but it makes you realize that idea of what maybe a business owner might look like isn't always what the reality is.
Right, and I want to go back to something someone mentioned earlier, you know, in sharing this, you know, bias works hand in hand with stereotyping and microaggressions, okay? And microaggressions come in three forms: micro invalidations, like you just described, being invalidated as an owner, micro assaults, and, you know, micro invalidations and micro assaults, and what's the other one? But they play with each other. They play on each other. They reinforce each other. So we just want to be, you know, cognizant of that as well, that there's more at play here. And so we have to really be conscious of, you know, unpacking that. But we've all had these, you know, biased thoughts, and all have experienced some bias. And you know intrinsically when it's happening, right? And so don't ever dismiss it and tell yourself, oh, maybe I'm just being too sensitive, or, you know, maybe it's invalid. You know, whatever you're feeling, your perceptions, they're valid. And, you know, and you don't want to, and thinking about your own feelings, when others share their thoughts and experiences, you also want to be present in their own experience and validate their experience as authentic. Okay, we can move to the next slide. Thank you all for sharing.
Thank you. Now that we have an understanding of unconscious bias, and we know that it exists and that it can become actionable discrimination under state and federal laws, let's discuss more specifically what to do about it in evaluating your candidates. However, as Chancellor Rose highlighted, let's first look at, ways that you have already worked with Gary and Carlos to attract a very diverse pool of candidates. Kim and I were impressed by your executive leadership profile. It is incredibly well drafted. It clearly articulates strategic priorities or opportunities of the next president. It also has objective leadership attributes or leadership qualifications needed for the individual to be successful as your next president. And as a general rule, the more objective the job criteria, the less likely the subjective judgments of the committee members or people reviewing those the applications will influence them, the less likely it is that unconscious bias will influence them in reviewing candidates. In addition, the presidential profile and ad were very carefully worded to attract diverse and qualified candidates. Research shows that even subtle word choices can impact the composition of a candidate pool. And I think it's probably fair to say that because you're documentation was so carefully worded that you have such a robust pool. In reviewing your documents, we noticed that you did strike a balance between female and male coded words We also recognize that you use gender-neutral words, and even there was no use of pronouns. Next, in advertising, you executed a thoughtful advertising plan, and you intentionally targeted and reached out to women and underrepresented minorities. You also built diversity through recruiting. You invited the college to recommend members or recommend individuals that your consultants could reach out to as potential candidates. And in addition, your consultants contacted their own diverse network of individuals. And that included, in fact, Kim and I were on part of their networks. That included Gary and Carlos's AGB colleagues, which represents 46% women leaders, and I believe it's 29% underrepresented minorities. So there was a very intentional effort to ensure that you had as diverse a pool as you possibly could have. Going forward, there also are a number of precautions that you can take to keep bias in check and to further promote diversity as you move into the candidate review stage and the interviewing stage. First, in evaluating candidates, it's important to again focus on the objective job criteria that you so intentionally set forth in your leadership profile. In fact, it's a good idea to use the profile, review the profile before evaluating candidates, because again, this helps you to be neutral and impartial in your review. Your consultants may create a matrix or sort of a handy worksheet for you to use that summarizes those job-related leadership qualifications as a handy checklist for reviewing candidates. Next, search committee members or individuals doing a candidate review should really thoughtfully plan your review time, allowing sufficient time to review the material of each candidate is essential. Again, research shows that if the brain is rushed or tired or even distracted, that it creates a greater opportunity for subjective judgment or bias to influence the decision-making of who should advance in the search or who should be your next president. Therefore, search committee members should be planful and also pace yourself in reviewing candidate material. And this is just in my opinion, and this is just my opinion, and I'm pretty skilled now at reviewing candidate material. I typically allow myself, approximately 20 minutes to review a candidate's material before I decide whether they should advance or not advance in a search. And then during the reviews, when you're reviewing candidate material, be sure and take intentional breaks. You know, give your brain a rest and pause and reflect on each candidate. Next, in evaluating candidates, be self-reflective. As Kim mentioned earlier, given your awareness of bias, you know, stop and ask yourself, am I allowing any biases to come into play here because of the name of the individual whose material I'm reviewing, or because I've noticed that that individual is a member of certain clubs or organizations, or because that individual has published in certain publications. So, you know, stop and try to keep your own biases in check. If you notice that your evaluation of a candidate might be rooted in bias or stereotypes, make a conscious effort to just stop and adjust your evaluation accordingly. Reflect on your attitude. Listen to your heart, listen to your head. Remember that bias can results in cognitive errors in thinking and in decision making. So don't use any, don't allow any preconceived ideas about the information you're reviewing to make a decision. Try to always remain objective. Finally, it also helps to adopt an overall goal throughout the search of getting to know the candidate at each stage of the search process. Spend time considering each individual on a personal level. You know, what are their hard skills? What are their soft skills? What is the breadth and depth of their leadership experience? Avoid speculation or making assumptions about a candidate. For example, avoid an assumption that, oh my gosh, this person is just too good of a candidate to come to Nevada. That person will never come. Let's not waste a spot inviting them to campus. You know, don't speculate and make assumptions. Make sure that your decisions on reviewing candidates are grounded in fact. And with that, I'm going to turn it back over to Kim. But you know what, Kim? I am now reminding myself that I think we may have missed the case study.
Let's see. I think it's coming up.
Is it?
Oh, no, it's not. You're right. We want to put that in. Well, why don't we do that after?
Okay, after interviews. Okay, sounds good. This is okay. Just one of those days.
No, we have the case coming up after the bias slide. So I'll go ahead and wrap it up with interviews, risk and reward. So you don't want to. So I always say in the interview, you want to risk. You don't want to risk being the judge instead of the juror. So be a juror, not the judge. Hear all the evidence before deciding yes or no. Okay. Don't make snap judgments. You know, wait 30 minutes before making any yes or no decisions. And, you know, measure first impressions at the end. Determine if the person's first impression will help or hinder on the job success. Don't make that determination up front. And check yourself in the final analysis when you're debriefing. As a committee, ask yourself, you know, are there any biases coming here into this space as we, you know, reflect on the interviews? And of course, you want to have the same interview questions for the candidates. You want to make sure that the playing field is level, and that, you know, some candidates aren't getting questions that are tailored to their vita as opposed to the job. Okay, so define the job, not the person. Focus on what the candidate will do in the role. Okay, so that's a little bit about the risk. And the rewards is that if you pay attention to this and do this in a way that's mindful and purposeful, you will end up with the best candidate for the position and not someone that is in the role based on some bias that creeped into the decision-making process. Okay, the next slide. So here are some biases that can typically creep into the interview process. Affinity bias. Of course, this is like similarity bias. And it is unfortunately played out a lot in recruitment and selection. This is when we feel a natural affinity towards a candidate due to something we have in common with them. We come from the same town, we went to the same school, we know the same people. And so that's how affinity bias can creep in if you feel like the person's better suited for the position based on some of those things over others. And then confirmation bias creeps in and supports affinity bias. You know, everyone is quick to pass judgments. We're all guilty of it. And, you know, in this process, as recruitment and selection happens, it can creep in. We make snap decisions based on a perceived truth, right? That might be related to that affinity that I just talked about. So a truth, and then we spend the rest of the time subconsciously trying to justify that. Okay, this is where we ask irrelevant questions, trying to elicit answers that support our initial assumption about the candidate. You're trying to confirm the bias that you've already settled on. We do this because we want to believe that we are right about our instincts and that our assessment of the candidate is correct. In fact, 60% of interviewers will make a decision about a candidate's suitability within 15 minutes of meeting them. Some will have done it before the interview even happens. So, you know, the obvious danger here is that we could be passing over great candidates for no real reason at all. Attribution bias. It can skew your view of a candidate's performance by minimizing accomplishments while amplifying faults or shortcomings. It may cause you to disregard a talented candidate. Humans snap to quick judgments and falsely assume things about people without knowing the full story. So when hiring, attribution bias may cause hiring managers to find someone unfit for the role because something unusual on their resume, like a gap in 2 years. Conformity bias is often shows up in how your decision making can be affected by group peer pressure or a fear of being thought of poorly by our peers or being ridiculed can allow us to be swayed by others. Imagine if you're on a panel and you're the only one who thinks a particular candidate did well. Would you say so and go against the rest of the interviewers or allow yourself to be swept along by the majority and potentially let a great candidate slip through the net? So that's how those biases play out. So now we're going to look at the case study. The next slide. So we sent the case out to everyone, right? You all got a chance to read that?
Yes, we do have that in our supplemental materials.
Okay, so case study. I'll just recall this for us, and then we can have a discussion about it. Five candidates were interviewed for the presidency. All were asked the following question. In your experience, what is the key to developing a good team? Look for how they built mutual trust, respect, and cooperation. Carrie's candidacy. All candidates seem to have solid experiences and accomplishments as they describe answering this question. Amy, a more senior leader on the committee, shared the following. I just found it hard to believe Terry's answers to the question. She was very quiet and low energy. I don't know if she's confident enough. I have a hard time imagining that she would be commanding enough. Does she feel like a leader to you? David, a member of the board on the committee, stated, Terry gave the most detailed examples when answering the question, but they were touchy-feely in nature. Della, another committee member, commented, Terry was very successful in her last leadership role, particularly in this area. Also, she disclosed that she is in the neutral site interview stage with one of our next level peer institutions. If they're about to move her forward, we probably should too. Is there any unconscious bias you might call out for consideration in this discussion? Your thoughts. I wish we could have had this on the screen. That might have been better. So, we just went over some types of bias. Affinity, confirmation, attribution, and conformity. Do you see any of that in this case?
I'll start off by go ahead, Eric. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, I see the unfortunate historical application to female candidates who are soft-spoken and therefore not strong enough. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's right there.
So that's gender bias.
Absolutely.
What about, and so attribution bias, that could have been creeping in here as well to back that up. Remember attribution bias? Skewing the candidate's performance by minimizing an accomplishment while amplifying faults or shortcomings may cause you to disregard a talented candidate. So calling her low energy, quiet, and then attributing that to her ability to be commanding enough to lead.
Anyone else?
I was also going to mention maybe conformity bias when one of the committee members said, well, another peer institution is going to push her forward, so maybe we should as well. Is that a bias in this situation?
Yes, and that can also be called prestige bias. You know, a Next Step institution is looking, they're more prestigious, so maybe we should do it too. Maybe we should advance her as well. There's all kinds of biases. The list goes on and on. These are just some that we want to highlight here that happen in this kind of a search committee dialogue. Anyone else?
Yes, this is Carol. When Dave said that that Terry had given most detailed examples when answering, but then he adds they were touchy-feely in nature. I mean, that's a huge bias.
Others, what did you notice? I know you mentioned conformity bias. Think about what Amy did as a leader. You kind of, you know, as a more senior leader in the committee, others might be influenced by her because she's more senior and she's already casting doubt on this person, on Terry.
I think that you got the horn effect going there.
Right. Other thoughts about Terry's interview?
This is Regent McMichael. I think they all bring forth their own particular bias towards a candidate. They all need to reflect why their bias is going to influence a decision. Mm-hmm. And they should then probably ask someone else that they can then bounce that information on and say, hey, you know, that was kind of sexist in that remark that you made. And then they can reflect back on that and say, you know what? I think that you're absolutely right, and I need to take that, you know, out of the equation when selecting.
And that's where you build that safety in the committee to create that space for you to call that out, and that's so important because it doesn't help anyone for you to notice that and just sit silent. And that's the kind of safety and community you want to build in the search committee process, because you're in service to finding the right leader, right? So how might this impact the organization?
Well, so from what I have seen, this happens frequently in higher ed when you have committees maybe chaired by a tenured faculty member and you have non-tenured folks on the committee. The non-tenured folks sometimes will be afraid to speak up, and we'll just go along with the tenured faculty member because that tenured faculty may end up on their tenure committee and they don't want to ruffle the feathers for their own personal growth within the institution. And I've seen that, unfortunately, many, many times in higher ed. So you end up not hiring the best candidate in many of those cases.
And that does no one any good. So, you know, setting this as a culture of equality, remember we talked about equity earlier? So when you bring your search committee together, you know, call this out at the beginning of the meeting. We're all equal here. Everyone's opinion is valued. We will call out any biases. We will question our own thoughts and assumptions together because that's going to make us all better. We're going to build capacity together to be aware and get the right candidate for the job.
This is Regent Carter. I'll just say one of my biggest concerns always about the searches is conformity bias, where, you know, you get two or three committee members on a row or a row saying the same candidate, kind of the same stuff, and it seems like it gets this forward momentum where people don't feel comfortable to say, well, here's the strengths of this other candidate, or really consider, you know, the breadth of what we've had to consider.
Absolutely, that happens all the time. But creating a culture is what you want to do to call this out. That's where the change happens. Any other thoughts?
I may add on to that. I was thinking of the question about how might this impact the organization. It seems like it's the definition of insanity. We keep hiring the same type of people going through the same type of process, so therefore the system just keeps perpetuating itself, even though we say that we want, you know, different outcomes and different outlooks. We just, like, we're in that groove where we keep doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result.
Absolutely. You have to be cognizant of the change you want that you're making at the beginning, the middle, and the end. So you want to set your system up for success and then debrief before any big decisions are made. You know, you can even have a checklist, you know, about, you know, in your deliberations, what you want to make sure you check in on. Okay, we'll go to the next slide. And of course, you know, leadership matters. We all lead and we make decisions every minute of the day, right? So this comes from Deloitte's six C's of inclusive leadership traits. And highly effective leaders are cognizant, because bias is a leader's Achilles heel, right? Inclusive leaders have courage, because talking about imperfections involves personal risk-taking. Inclusive leaders make a commitment to staying the course, even though it's hard. You know, thinking about what you're thinking and practicing this is something that you have to be conscious about, and modeling that for others. As a leader, you can model that and change the whole organization. Collaboration is important to be an inclusive leader, because a diverse thinking team is greater than the sum of its parts. And you want to advance cultural intelligence and cultural humility, because not everyone sees the world through the same cultural frame. And lastly, be curious and model that, because different ideas and experiences enable growth. The next slide.
And I like this slide because it's a reminder that there is no question that regular, ordinary people like all of us can try to make a difference, even if it's in our own small way, to really make the world a better place. There truly is hope, and history is filled with people who took small steps, just ordinary people who took small steps that led to critical change. And as search committee members, just a few quick little reminders. Remember to, as Kim mentioned, be outspoken on your committees. You know, be courageous. Leadership takes courage. Also, as committee members, avoid speculation and don't make assumptions about a candidate, and ensure that your decisions are fact-based. Next slide, please.
And we all have to work together. We're in this together. As I said, you're in service to finding the right leader for the institution. And so we have to put our personal our personal, you know, issues aside and our personal preferences aside, being aware of your biases and in the decision-making process will help you with that, because ultimately the right leader is going to benefit the institution on the whole. And so that's really important to think about yourselves as working together as a team and not as individuals. Next slide. So now it's time for questions and reflections. Your initial thoughts about how you might apply this in your committee.
This is Carol. I think this training is a start. I mean, it makes you more aware, and I think it has been a very fruitful discussion. And I've been on the board since I started in 2017, and I've been on, gosh, I think at least 6 search committees. And I really have to say that I think we've hired, let's see, we have 8 presidents. We've hired 7 presidents since I've been a member. Mm-hmm. And I think we have done a marvelous job, and we actually did not have any training prior to any of these. But if you look at our presidents, we have a very diverse pool. They are very talented, and I'm just really proud of the job we've done since I've been on the board. And some of the examples that came out today, I think we have seen, but I really always believe that the cream rises to the top. So the person that said that you go around the room and we're all saying the same thing, I found that to be really true in the selection process when they come to the regions. And the regions, I think, do a really good job setting aside and allowing those advisory committee members to speak first. I think that's really important in our process, because they see things differently than, of course, we do. We all do. But I think it really kind of sets the tone of what we end up reaching that consensus on. And in the ones I've been in, we just have not had, it's really been a real majority group consensus of where we've reached. And I think this is a really great process. And I have been the chair of a committee, and it really does start at a well-crafted CV. We don't see the person. We just are reading that CV. And when you have 90, I think we had 70 on the committee I did. I mean, you really, with your search consultants, really, that's where the separation starts. But I've been very pleased with our process, and this is just enhancing it today. So thank you for the training. And like I said, this just is scratching the surface. I hope we, as a board, continue to develop and be trained in these areas. It's very important. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Anyone else?
Well, I just wanted to say thank you for your training today to you, Dr. Bobby, and to Ms. McCambridge. I really do appreciate the work that you put into this and to open our eyes to bias and to really understand where we could do better to make the best decision for our institution. And I also just wanted to give maybe a quick overview of how our selection process will work on the day that the all of the members of the committee come back together, because you, as committee members, you've heard a lot about what we should be doing, but you may not understand what it looks like on the day that we actually do the interviews. And so, Chancellor Rose had said earlier, at this point, she's working with AGB on narrowing down the semifinalists, going through all of the applications and materials. And she will bring to us, along with our search consultants, a slate of finalists to come to the campus, I believe, Monday, April 26th, then Tuesday, April 27th. The finalists will be on the Nevada State campus. There'll be forums that the public, faculty, students can come to learn about the finalists and ask questions. And hopefully, I know in previous searches, we've also done a survey afterwards of those who have participated in the forums to get their feedback on how they viewed the finalists. That information will come back to the committee on April 28th when we do the final interviews with the candidates, the finalists. So we will get the results of the surveys and we will interview each of those candidates. And the way that we've done it in the past is we've had a slate of questions for us to participate with the finalists. We will ask the same questions of each finalist and make our decisions based on that. Since this is an open meeting, we have to follow open meeting law. We won't be able to deliberate privately. But I do hope that we'll have good dialogue, robust discussion about each of the candidates and pick the best candidate for Nevada State. And I think that's where this training really comes into play is while we're listening to each candidate and them answering the questions that we'll be asking of them, we'll have to think about how they will best fit into our campus community at Nevada State. So that's where this training really is important, is for that day when we are going through the finalists and the interviews. It's going to be a long day. They always are very long, but they're very, very productive and they really are good days. I think that week is going to be a very positive week. It's going to be the next chapter in Nevada State's history. And we want to make sure that we have the best person in that leadership role that we possibly can. So that's why you're all a part of this and we want to make sure that you are as well equipped to find that next leader of Nevada State that we possibly can have. So that's kind of a rough overview of how this training fits into all of that. I know that in some ways many of you have had experience in the selection process of leaders of your respective organizations. Sometimes the presidential process might look a little bit different than other processes. So there's that. And again, thank you, Dr. Bobby and Ms. McCambridge for this really insightful training for us today. It is very different than what we've done in the past, but when I saw the AGB offered this, I thought it was a great opportunity to offer this to our community members. So thank you.
It's our pleasure.
Our pleasure. Thank you. Thank you.
Of course. Chancellor, did I miss anything on what we might be expecting upcoming? Did you want to add anything to that?
No, I think the only additional thought for the record, Melody Rose, the only additional thought I had is Chair Carvalho, maybe we could have a look at the surveys that various constituency groups fill out when they have interactions with the candidates and kind of apply what we've learned today to those surveys, because I think that's another way for us to connect what we've learned. And, you know, I don't recall the questions on those surveys, but, you know, there may be an improvement that we can make based on the presentations today. And so maybe you and I can talk about that in our meeting later today.
Very good. I like that idea. I think that would be good. In the past, the search consultants have provided that at the meeting. But if we are able to get some of that in advance, that might be very helpful for the committee members. Thank you.
Great. And I'd just like to thank you, Chair Carvalho, for raising this opportunity for the Regents and the Ad Hoc Advisory Committee. As we've said before, we have not taken this additional step in our presidential search process before. And I really just want to thank you and your leadership on this issue. I think it's a best practice because all of us on the screen here are also involved in other searches on our campuses and in our organizations. So what we've learned today will improve our process for the NSC search, but hopefully many other searches as well. So there's a trickle-down effect, and I just want to thank you for your leadership on this.
Thank you. I appreciate that. And I thank you to AGB for offering this to us. I think it is very important. We, like I said before, it's important to be intentional about our biases and maybe what we don't always realize is going on in our own minds as we speak to other people. And so having this time to reflect on that is very important. And I think it's a very productive exercise that we've had today. Thank you. Okay, were there any other questions for our presenters today, or anything that you'd like to, that the committee members would like to add to this training, or any thoughts that you might have? No, everybody's quiet today. All right. Okay, then I guess we will move on to item number 5, new business. Is there any new business that anyone would like to add? Nope. Okay, item number 6, public comment. Winter, do we have any public comment?
No public comment.
Oh, thank you, Winter. Okay, well, then this concludes the meeting of the Ad Hoc Nevada State Presidential Search Committee. I appreciate all the time that you've spent with us today, and we look forward to our meeting later in April. Have a great weekend, everybody. Bye-bye.